it's Canzano. Thanks for making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe and leave us some feedback. Also, the podcast is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic, dedicated to providing breakthrough, non-invasive, drug-free solutions to ED problems. Call Multnomah Medical Clinic at 503-899-4199 or visit them online at multnomahmedical.com.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Well, we've chased a lot of guests on this show, and I started this week by chasing my dad, who is visiting, Tony Canzano, former minor league baseball player. My dad played in the Mets organization and ultimately the Expos organization, grew up in the Bay Area. I finally convinced him to come on the show, and this morning at the breakfast table over coffee, he got a napkin out and he started jotting down some notes. I'm a little nervous here. How are you doing, Dad?
Doing good.
Good to have you on. So let's start here. Let's start with your background, like as a kid. You grew up in the San Jose area. You went to Willow Glen High School. Oregon fans may remember, is it Bob Berry who played at Willow Glen and then went to?
Yeah, his dad, same name, Bob Berry, was the coach for years at Willow Glen. And then his son, Bob, who played in the NFL and at Oregon, right?
He played at Oregon, yeah. A lot of Oregon fans may remember that.
Played for him. And then he had another son, Ken Berry, that came after, that played quarterback at San Jose State. Actually, they had a national record of winning 42 games in a row without...
In high school?
Yeah.
Football?
Yeah. They used to play 8 games a year then, so it was like almost, over 5 years they had won every game.
You played baseball and football in high school at Willow Glen High School. Yeah. What about youth baseball? We had a listener who asked me to ask you about the Colt League World Series must have been mid-1960s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Early 1960s, maybe.
It was like 63, maybe, something like that. Yeah, we ended up going to Shawnee, Oklahoma to play in the World Series. There was 4 teams, and we had a 2-0 lead going into the final games, and then we lost 2 in a row to some team in South Carolina.
That's like 60 years ago. How do you remember you were leading 2-0 in the sixth inning? I'm like, I don't remember breakfast. What did I have? I don't know. So, you're 17 years old when your high school senior year starts. And by that time, you got the attention of scouts. You have a scout from the New York Mets who wants to sign you. How did that go down in that era? This is pre-baseball draft. So how does that work out? They knock on the door and want to talk to your parents, or what happens?
Yeah, well, we were playing in a summer league, kind of a semi-pro league after high school, and one of the bird dogs came out and talked to me after a game. And then Roy Partee, who was the Mets scout, came around later, and the impending event close was you had to sign before the draft, otherwise you're not going to get any money ever, which didn't work out that way.
Yeah.
So I signed a few days before the draft went into effect.
How much did you get?
I got $8,000.
That must have felt like $1 million.
It was a
18-year-old kid. What do you do with your signing boat? Your $8,000. What did Grandma tell you to do with that?
Grandma told me to save it.
Yeah.
My dad said to buy some real estate.
Yeah.
And I ended up buying 120 acres of land in outside Ashland.
There you go.
And that's how you got to Oregon.
There you go.
And the rest of it, I bought a Sunbeam Tiger. My dad's idea there.
Convertible sports car.
Yeah. So now it's like a collectible.
There you go. Yeah, I'm glad you bought that land, because then, I have the New York Mets to thank for the fact that I was born in the state of Oregon. So I'm native. My dad is the guest on the show. Was there a decision between whether you would attend college or sign that contract, or how did that work at that time?
Well, the deal with my parents was that I had to promise to finish college. And so what I would do is in the wintertime, I'd go to school and try to pick up enough units during the wintertime to get my degree. So I ended up with 3 years in college. I didn't fulfill my promise. I'm still a senior.
There's still time. You get online now. Everybody's going. You could be in a Zoom class with your granddaughter now next year. All right, your first year in professional baseball, it's Greenville, South Carolina, which you probably had never heard before. That's the Mets. Is that a short season A-ball or was that long, regular A-ball?
Yeah,
for the Mets?
Spring training and everything.
How did that go?
It was depressing. It was they ran 50 guys through that team. Guys were getting released left and right. At the end of the year, they took a picture of four of us, and they said, "These are the four original Greenville Mets."
Wow.
Everybody else was gone.
Wow.
So it was pretty scary.
Yeah, and you're 18 years old. You're away from home. And are you around other 18-year-olds, or were these like 25-year-old people who were hanging on to baseball and A-ball?
Yeah, well, these guys were mostly early 20s, and so that was difficult. You know, physically maturing an 18 versus a 21-year-old even is a big difference. And the other thing is, you know, I went to school early.
Yeah.
So I should have been in high school.
Right.
Playing high school ball, and here I was in A-ball. Yeah, my birthday was in December, so.
The on your notes there, you wrote down a word, Lexington. What is that about? What is Lexington?
Well, Lexington was one of the teams we played against in the Carolina League. It was a Giants farm club.
Mm.
Bobby Bonds was there.
Oh, wow.
He had 40 home runs that year.
Wow.
Man amongst boys. 18 years old, 40 home runs.
Wow.
And so anyway, we were playing a day game. It's hot and muggy. We walk in after the game. We're all dirty and sweaty. And a few of the guys go in the showers and they come out complaining there's no hot water. And then they looked around. There's no towels.
Wait, you had cold water and no towels.
Yeah.
After a game?
After a game, we're supposed to get dressed and get on the bus and take a 3-hour ride home.
Yeah.
So Clyde McCullough, our manager, who was a real character, great guy, he said, "Boys, let me show you how to take a shower that's cold and no towels."
Okay.
So we're looking at him. He gets naked. He stands up. He goes in the shower, turns on the cold water. Soaps down,
yeah.
Comes out. He says, "Now I'm going to show you how to dry off." And he gets his hand and wipes his body all over. And so we looked at him, and everybody went in the cold shower and wiped down, got dressed.
You never forget that.
He was a great leader.
Yeah.
What a great leader.
He was a major league player who had played catcher and ended up playing, I think, in a World Series with the Cubs. And then he die mid-season? And was it one of your seasons that he passed away?
Yeah, my last year he had a heart attack. And actually, I think he recovered from that, but he was gone. He was gone mid-season.
Yeah.
And he died a year or two later, I think in a hotel. He was a bullpen coach or something at that time.
You mentioned that he would jump into workouts, and here he was like, he was... What? How old was he then? And you guys were in your early 20s.
He must have been 50s, maybe 60. We'd have some infield, and the catchers, he was showing the catchers how to quickly release the ball. And he'd throw down to second base, and he had the best arm of any of the catchers.
Yeah.
Very accurate and got rid of the ball quick. He was amazing.
You had teammates through the minor leagues that you saw either in spring training or full season. Who were some of the teammates that you had that went to the big leagues in that organization?
Jerry Kuzman was a guy who came out of Greenville. John Matlack, Rod Gaspar, Ken Singleton, outfielders. Leroy Stanton, outfielder. Let's see, Bob Heiss, Duffy Dyer, Mike Jorgensen.
Yeah.
Have a...
there, you know what's interesting to me is, as a kid, you mentioned kind of looking at Clyde McCullough, your manager, and throwing to second base. I remember watching you, probably you were in your 30s, taking ground balls. We would have a little league practice, and you were helping coach, and you'd take some ground balls, and it was like, we've all seen those middle infielders where the ball never touches their glove or doesn't look like it does. Their hands are just fast and smooth. You had those hands. Where'd you get those hands? Because I don't have those hands.
You got some of those hands. It's in the genes. Julie didn't do anything. I had my mother's brothers were pretty good athletes back in Pennsylvania. One of them had a scholarship, running back scholarship to Wake Forest. So
you've got Curtis Brown's name on your list. I've heard you talk about Curtis Brown. Good teammate, good player.
Yeah, Curtis signed the same time I did, right before the draft. He was an Afro-American out of Sacramento. We were sent to Greenville, South Carolina. Neither one of us had seen the racism that was there in the 60s. But the amazing thing about Curtis was that he played 8 years in the minors, got a call up to the he was with Montreal at that time also.
Yeah.
Called up to the majors, to the Expos. Gene Mock was a manager. He lasted a week. He played one game. He told me that he hit a really hard ground ball down the third baseline. Ron Bryant was pitching for the Giants. He was a 21-game winner. The ball was barely foul.
Yeah.
He ended up going 0 for 4. A few days later, he was sent back down to the minors.
Man, he got one game. He got one game.
One game out of 8 years, and he went on to play in the minors, the Mexican League mostly, another 7 years. He played 15 years.
Wow. I looked at, I mentioned before the break, you were 24 years old when you retired. You were in Winnipeg in AAA with the Expos. I keep saying I wish I had a time machine. I could go back. I would get in your ear, and I'd say, listen, you're not done. Come back one more year. Why, at age 24, do you hang it up?
A couple of reasons. I was playing every day in Winnipeg. The first month, I was hitting over 300 and had seven homers. And then fatigue set in, and I ended up hitting 220. And there was a general manager from the Expos that came down to see us play. And I talked to him in the outfield, and I asked him if I had a future with Montreal and if I was going to get a big league contract on the roster. And he kind of laughed and said no. And I said, well, thanks for being honest with me. And that kind of did it for me. So there was no future. They weren't interested in me. And then when I went home, I tried to, I was at a park and I was trying to run wind sprints, and I could just feel it in my heart that it wasn't there anymore. I didn't want to go back.
You had that previous year had been traded from the Mets organization to the Expos, and you were traded mid-season. Can we go back to that moment? Because here, you were with this organization that you had been with for 6 years. You'd been to Durham, you'd been to Memphis, you'd been to Tidewater, and all of a sudden, mid-season, you're changing teams. And in fact, Tidewater is playing Winnipeg at that time. You had been on a long road trip. You're traded. How did you know you were traded?
We come down into the lobby to get on the bus to go to the ballpark. And so we're all in the lobby, and the manager, who was Hank Bauer at the time, calls me over. And I knew something was up, so I said, that's okay. I don't want to talk to you.
Did you know guys were being traded released?
Traded and released.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be released. That was my main thing. So anyway, probably because of the Greenville thing with everybody going. So he kind of laughed, and he said, you've been traded to to Montreal. You're over at Winnipeg, and Clyde's here. Clyde McCullough was the manager at Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Clyde's here. He wants to see you in the coffee shop. So I went over to the coffee shop, and I was in shock.
Yeah.
You know, you have a dream of playing for a team. You know all the guys. You've gone up, grown up with them, and now that's blown up, and you're with another team.
You're literally trading dugouts.
Yeah.
How did that game go that later that day?
Went pretty well. So I traded dugouts, and
how did it feel to put on that other uniform?
It was kind of, they had a weird hat.
Yeah.
It looked like a beanie hat with a propeller. You know, it was red, white, and blue.
Yeah.
And anyway, and the uniform really didn't fit right. It was kind of tight.
Yeah.
That's all they had. They had really old uniforms. And so anyway, first at bat, I had a single to left field grounder between short and third. So I was glad Matlack was pitching.
Yeah.
And next time up, I hit a home run to center field. And that felt really good. So kind of revenge, you know.
When you step into the batter's box against Matlack, he'd been your pitcher. You were the shortstop on that team, and now you're facing him. Is there any kind of acknowledgement, or is it just we're professionals, step in the box?
Yeah, kind of professionals. You know, it's like you're competing against each other. You're trying to beat each other, and whatever happens, happens. It's okay. So that's, you know, different than real life. When I was selling real estate and I was competing with another friend of mine for a listing, he was offended that I was trying to get the same listing he was. You know?
Right.
But that's how sports is. You compete.
You've got some other things written down there that I want to touch on, including Duke Schneider. I am holding a clipping here, though, from 1967. You've got a Carolina League playoff game in which the Carolina League record for assists in a game was 11 entering that game. You had 10 going into the last inning. You got two ground balls in the ninth inning to break the record. You end up with 12 assists in the game, including four double plays that you guys turned. What is a game like that when you're playing shortstop and it's just ground ball, ground ball, ground ball, and you're constantly active?
Yeah. First of all, we had Jim Bethke was the pitcher, who was a sinker ball pitcher. So that's a big part of it. So there were a lot of ground balls. And Lexington at that time, very unusual for that. Carolina League had a beautiful infield, smooth, yeah. Really nice. And so anyway, it's, you know, it was surprising. I didn't know that was happening.
But you're during the course of the game at any point, you're like, man, I've been really active today, or... You know,
it's a good feeling because you get in a rhythm, you know, so you're ready for the ball and every pitch. You expect it, and it's just a good feeling.
And my dad has joined us on the show. For those of you just tuning in, minor league ball player, 7 years in the minor leagues, and I've convinced him to come on the show. In the news lately, we've been watching, you know, Lou Brock pass away, and then, you know, Joe Morgan passes away, and it's kind of that era, your era, of guys, and guys before and a little after you even,
yeah,
that are passing away. Tom Seaver, I remember texting you when Tom Seaver passed away, because he was with the Mets organization. What were your interactions with Seaver? What was he like?
Didn't know him, really. He, one day in spring training, he and Duffy Dyer came down, and I guess Seaver needed some work, so he pitched against us in a simulated game. And so I got one at bat against Seaver, and the thing that surprised me about him was his fastball was good. I guess he threw 95, but his slider was just crazy. It was it had no spin on it, so it was hard to recognize, and it broke quick. And about maybe four inches horizontally. So it looked like the pitch was going to be inside or hit you, and then it would be go over the plate for a strike. I ended up popping up.
He's not a big guy, is he?
No. And when he threw, he was very low. powerful legs. So
how about Louis Tion? You played against Louis Tion. Was that a spring training game too?
No, that was a regular season game. I think it was 69. Yeah, so Tion was out there, and he had a great curveball, and his fastball was good too. So I went up there thinking, I'm going to hit his curveball. And he threw me a fastball on the outside part, and I swung at it and hit a home run over the right field fence. The next time up, I'm still looking for the curveball, and he threw it, and I hit a double to left center. I ended up 4 for 5.
Off Louis Tion.
Off Louis Tion.
That's got to feel good.
That is real good. My dad was in the stands. Yeah. My mom and dad that day.
That's interesting. I want to talk to you about Gil Hodges and more coming up. If you have questions for my dad about minor league baseball in that era, you can call in at 503-417-7575. You got the bald-faced truth. Leave it here. Got my dad in studio. We're reminiscing about minor league baseball, the 1960s in America, showers, how to take a shower without having warm water or a towel. I hope you're enjoying it. If you have a question for him, you can tweet at me at John Canzano BFT, or you can call in at 503-417-7575. Somebody on Twitter asking if you knew Cookie Lavigato. You said no, but you knew Duke Snider.
Yeah.
What was Duke Snider like? Was he your manager or coach?
He was the manager at Tri-Cities, and he was a great guy. And he must have been in his mid to late 40s when he was at Tri-Cities, and he could hit. There was an exhibition game where they had Snider up, and I think before the game they were taking batting practice, like a home run derby.
Yeah.
He must have pumped 6 or 8 balls over the right field fence.
Yeah.
He could hit at that age. It was amazing. Better than anybody on the team.
Really? Even at that age?
Yeah. And just a really nice guy.
The we've talked before off air about, you know, the 1960s, and you mentioned Lexington and yourself and Curtis Brown, who was your teammate. You know, here he is. You're white, he's black, you're teammates, you're friends, you're in the South, and you're from a part of the country where you hadn't probably had to deal with restaurants that wouldn't serve black players. And how did that go down? Like when you pull into a minor league city and, you know, you're starting to get off the bus to go into a restaurant.
Yeah, we got off the bus, get something to eat, and you know, we had no idea coming from California. I think we had one black player in our school, and everybody loved him. He was much loved. So anyway, Curtis, who was very light-complected, and us, went into the restaurant to order. And when Curtis goes to order, the waitress asks him if he's an American Indian. And Curtis says, no, I'm a Negro. And she said, well, I'm sorry, we can't serve you here. So he turns around to walk out. So we all walked out with him. But we were shocked. Yeah. We had never seen anything like that. Another thing is they wouldn't allow the black fans to sit in the stands. They had to sit out in the bleachers in Greenville. So
that had to be, I mean, I'm so proud of you. I mean, it probably, you didn't even think of it at the moment. That's your teammate. They're not serving him. You're walking out. You're not going to stay there and eat.
Right. No question. So
let's take some phone calls. Steve is in Dallas. He says he saw you play. He's calling in. Steve, what's up?
Hey, welcome. Mr. Canzano. This is Steve Fung from Dallas, Oregon. I turned 16 in the summer of 69. And my mom let me drive her Mustang down to Jet Stadium in Columbus, Ohio. And the game that I attended, Clyde McCulloch, I believe, threw a lit cigarette in a trash can and it caught on fire. Were you playing in that game?
I don't remember that. 69, I was there.
Okay, and the only reason why I called in, this is great, Columbus, the old Jet Stadium, but I wanted to know, how cantankerous was Clyde McCullough?
I think he was more cantankerous with umpires and sports writers than he was with us. He was pretty loyal with us, and I mean, he could be stern at times.
But you loved him.
I loved him. Well, I remember him saying once when we were in Durham that he was going to win the pennant, and if we didn't win it for him, he'd get somebody else that would. So
I love that.
Sure enough, he won. We won that year. So
yeah, he won. When you look at his managerial career, he won everywhere he went. He was a winner. Let's go to Mark, who's in Portland. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, hi. I want to thank your dad for raising such a great kid. And first of all, you did a great job with John. We appreciate him.
Thank you. Mom did it.
Yeah, in the 1960s, you know, I'm an old guy, so I don't think people realize baseball was more popular than the NFL at that time. And my I've heard John talk about you before, and I just wanted to ask you what it was like to have to make the decision at 24, 25 years old. I can't even imagine having to make the decision to give up on your dream, because you sound like you were right on the borderline from going to the show. And I also wanted to bring up, I was a big Cardinals fan, if you ever faced Bob Gibson or Mickey Lolich, who was a Portland guy, and contrast and compare them for us, those two pitchers.
Never hit against either one of them, but I have a Gibson story. We're in Memphis in 68, and the Cardinals came down to put on a promotion for an ice cream company. And so they're in Memphis. Gibson's there. What was the catchers? McCarver, Kurt Flood, and the shortstop Maxville. So they're all in the locker room, and Gibson had his street clothes, and he had put it in my locker. And I was one of the guys that was going to be there to shag balls, to do demonstrations as they explained how to do double plays and things. So I picked up Gibson's clothes and moved it over a couple of lockers. Well, Gibson came by, looked for his clothes, looked at me, saw his clothes were over there, gave me a dirty look, and walked away. Then Kurt Flood was sitting there with the sports writer, and they were talking about free agency. Mm. He was the guy that started that. And then the catcher, McCarver, he was kind of a promo guy. He was there with a restaurant. He may have been at his restaurant that they were going to. So anyway, our catcher, Ezell, great Glenn Ezell, said it was our spokesman. So he was trying to get us some money for this promotion. So he was looking for $100 a piece.
Right.
Because those guys were getting thousands.
Right.
And that didn't work. They didn't want to give us any money. So Glenn went to the dairy company and said, hey, how about give us some ice cream? Because we're here. We've got a game tonight. We're coming out early. And no, they wouldn't give us any ice cream either.
You couldn't even get ice cream.
We got nothing.
You got nothing.
Yeah.
Did you get to see, you ever see like hard-throwing pitchers that you faced? Who threw the hardest?
Let's see. I played behind Nolan Ryan in spring training. He nailed a guy in the back. And he was in agony. So who else?
Well, so when you have Nolan Ryan on the mound and you're playing shortstop, what's that like? Are you just standing around watching him strike guys out?
Yeah, mostly standing around, either striking them out or walking them. The Mets made a bad trade. They got rid of him for Fergozzi, I think.
Yeah.
And they didn't give him enough time. He was he turned out to be a wonderful pitcher, as everybody knows.
You know, we've talked about sort of race relations. We've talked about, your time in baseball. And you got Wilbur Huckle's name written down there. And he's a character that I've heard about over the years. I heard about Wilbur Huckle as a kid, and then I later found out, did he run for president?
Great story. So Hucknall was a prospect in the Mets organization in their early years, 63, 64, I believe. And so the Mets fans, they wanted some hope for this team that was god-awful. So it was during an election, a national election, and they created the Metropolitan Party. And they made Hucknall their candidate for the Metropolitan Party for running for president. And I have his button says that. I got it on eBay. And Hucknall was a character. I roomed with him for a couple of years. He ended up being a biology teacher, managed in the minor leagues after his career playing. And he must be about 80 years old now.
I have been talking, and I talked yesterday about how hard it is in football, basketball, baseball, for the professionals to get to the top of their game in the league. And what did you learn in professional sports that maybe you could tell people who either watch sports, who have kids, who play sports? What advice do you give them? What do you tell them about what you learned?
First of all, they need to know who they are. If they have a certain way of doing something, maybe it's a little different than everybody else. Continue with that. Don't try to change to be midstream, ordinary, this is how you do it type of thing. So if you're an infielder with a not so strong arm, but you throw guys out halfway down the line because you charge the ball and you throw them out with your legs, continue that. If you're hitting, you have a certain way and you're successful at it, you don't need to change. Because most of these guys that are instructors in the minor leagues back then were just players that came down, and now you're a hitting coach. So, believe in yourself. And if somebody says you can't do something, don't believe it. So
I thought it was interesting when you talked about Louis Tiant and your bat against him. You were looking for a curveball, but he threw you a fastball on the outside part of the plate. You swung anyway.
Yep.
Why?
I don't know. I have no idea.
You step in with a plan, and then he winds up, and you go, you know what? This looks good, too.
Yeah, the ball was away, so yeah. It's kind of like where I was looking, and it just worked out that way. I don't know.
All right, stick around. We got one more segment to go with Dad. Marcus Lattimore later in the show, former South Carolina running back. He's now in the state of Oregon. Leave it here. Different show today. I've dragged my dad on the show, former minor league baseball player. We've been talking about a lot of different things. I want to talk to you about getting a Louisville Slugger bat contract, sports trading card contracts, the inside baseball stuff, literally. We've got a minute here, Dad, and then after this quick commercial break, we'll come back on and maybe we can finish up by talking about some of that inside baseball stuff. You've lately been pointing out all the people that you played with who have passed away. And I remember my grandfather, your dad, doing the same thing, kind of showing a picture and going, they're all dead now, as he shows the picture. That's got to be different. What's happened to players? Are there still some guys around?
Yeah, but give you an example. In Winnipeg, there's a picture of our dugout, and there's eight players in there, and I looked them up on the baseball reference guide.
Finish this in a second. I gotta cut you off because we're gonna take a quick commercial break.
Okay.
And I'll let you finish that, and then we'll talk about the Louisville Slugger baseball factory and how that all works when you get a contract with Louisville Slugger. Leave it here. Marcus Lattimore later in the show.
BFFT. Live from the home studios, presented by High Caliber Millwrights. Here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Been a different show. The first hour has flown by. And I don't know if you're enjoying it, but I'm enjoying it. You can tweet at me at John Canzano BFT. You can call in if you'd like. If you have a question at 503-417-7575. During the commercial break, I just walked out into the kitchen. My mom is pacing. She's listening to the show and pacing back and forth because I pulled dad onto the show today. It's not Father's Day, but it is kind of Father's Day on this radio show, as he has joined us to talk about his minor league baseball career and other things. Mom's out there pacing. She's worried what you're going to say. What are you going to, you know?
Of course.
She's a little nervous.
50-something years, she's worried.
She's worried. I want to ask you were talking about looking at the photograph of your teammates in the dugout and eight teammates that you saw. In fact, the Winnipeg, the AAA affiliate of the formerly the AAA affiliate of the Expos, reached out when they found out you were alive, and they said, could you identify the other players in the dugout? What do you see, and where were you going with that? You said there's eight players that you saw.
There's eight players that I saw, and I looked up each player, and of the eight, six have passed away, which is totally shocking to me because we're talking 70s and younger.
Yeah.
They passed away.
Right. So what does that make you do? Does it make you, like, seize the day? Like, you know, how old are you? What are you, 74?
73.
73. You'll be 74 this year.
Yeah.
So what does that make you do? You going to go out and buy a motorcycle, take a trip? What are you going to do?
I told my wife the other day, I said, you know, time is short. We should celebrate. She loves root beer floats. So we're in the grocery store. I said, let's get some vanilla ice cream and some root beer and have a root beer float today. We haven't had one in years. And then I told my other son, Ben, about that. And he said, Dad, you need to think a little bigger.
That's right. Buy an RV. Take a trip. You don't want to travel anywhere.
I'm sick of traveling.
We have to drag you here to get you to come visit. And you like to be home. You like to be in your backyard.
I do. I love my backyard. Peace and quiet. And
people leave you alone there.
Yeah, do what you want.
I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and I walked into the Louisville Slugger plant. And they have on the wall in the, if you ever get a chance as a listener to go there, they have every signature panel from every player who ever signed a contract with the Louisville Slugger Baseball Bat Company on the wall. Like, you can literally take a piece of paper and a pencil, and you can kind of trace the signature of every player who has ever had a contract. You are in that museum. You had a bat contract with Louisville Slugger. With the what is that process like as a player?
I was in spring training. The Louisville guy's there, and he's looking for prospects. And our catcher, Glenn Ezell, said, hey, you should get this, sign this one guy up, Tony. He's a good prospect. So they signed me up. I got paid $100. And you get to sign your name on a bat instead of the block letters.
Right.
And that was it.
Did you get to pick your bat out, or how did that work every year?
Yeah, you order your bats, the model and the length and the weight, and then they shows up in the clubhouse, and you get about six or eight bats, and throw them in your locker, and go at it.
What bat did you use, or what model?
I used it was an experimentation. There's a M159 with a really thin handle that I used for a while. Then I went to a fat handle. It was a G69, and then I went to the bat that I thought had really good balance, and I still like it. It's M110. 35-inch and 33-ounce.
How do they name the bats? What's M110?
I don't know. There's another one, K55. I think that was K-line.
I see.
M159 might have been Wally Moon.
Mm-hmm.
M110, maybe Mantle, I don't know.
Yeah, and really interesting. It's one of the oldest. It was developed in 1944, here it says. So it's somebody who came from that era. Alabama Adriana's got a question. What's your question?
Well, first of all, hi, Papa Tony. It's been a treat to listen to you guys. This has just been amazing. My question was, when you went away to play ball, were you married to your wife? And if you were, how did y'all manage the long-distance relationship? Because today we have social media, we have texting, we have everything. You could talk whenever, but did you write letters? Did you come home every now and then? Like, how did that work?
We were, when I was 18, we were boyfriend, girlfriend, and had been going together for a couple years since 16. at the high school. And so I went away. I was single. Next year, I was 19. I was still single. The year, third year at Durham, we got married, and we went off together. So we were together on those journeys every year.
How did it change for you when you had mom around after, you know, being kind of alone out there by yourself for a couple of years?
Yeah, it was more fun because the guys that were married would get together. So the wives would, when we were on the road, they'd get together and have parties and have dinner and stuff. And so there was more social activities. And so it was good.
Judah Newby, you got a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, and Papa Tony, it's great to hear you. Thanks for taking time with JC. It's been a lot of fun. I was curious, sign stealing in the game of baseball, what do you consider to be competing hard, you know, between the lines, trying to pick signs if you're a runner off second, that type of thing? Where do you draw the line in terms of what is competition and what is straight cheating? And as it relates to the Houston Astros, should they be punished more for what they did from your experience
how would that
as a player?
Fly? Yeah. Banging on the trash can, stealing signs. What's fair game? What's well, crossing the line?
I think the third base coach stealing signs from the catcher. Catcher's supposed to hide his signs. That's fair game. We had, you know, once you have the sign, then what do you do with it? For example, when we were in Tidewater in 69, Clyde had the same signs that he had in Durham. He didn't change them. So we told the manager, Bauer, we have their signs. And he was skeptical. What do you mean you have their signs? We have their signs. So we had to show him what the signs were. And then so we said, okay, this guy's bunting. So Bauer yells out, bunt.
Yeah.
But it didn't help anything because
right.
it was too late, you know? And it did mess us up once because, I was playing shortstop and, Adolfo Phillips was on first base, the Panamanian Express, fast runner. So he was going to steal second. I saw the steal sign that Clyde gave. So I changed the, coverage to who would take the ball at second base to tag him out, to me instead of the second baseman. Cause I saw he was, it was like a hit and run actually. So, but the second baseman didn't see it. So I ended up running him over and manager was irate.
Yeah.
Thought we didn't know who was going to cover.
When you're hitting, do you want the sign? Because some guys will say they want the sign, they don't want the sign. Harold Reynolds told me he never wants the sign. He never wanted the sign as a player.
Hmm.
Did you want the sign?
Sure, I'd like to have the sign. But I wouldn't want it from the center field scoreboard. I think that's cheating for sure.
Yeah. And so what advantage is that? Like, let's just, the Astros, if they devise the sign, they're getting it on video, they're banging the trash can, the hitter knows when he hears the banging trash can, it's a fastball. Is that how much of an advantage is that?
Huge. Huge. Like batting practice.
Yeah.
You know, a curveball's coming. It's a lot different than looking for a pitch in an area or fastball, curveball, slider, and here's a curveball. So you just sit on the curveball and... it's much easier. Well, you've seen batting practice. They throw curveballs or fastballs, and you know what it is, and everybody's ripping the ball for doubles and home runs and line drives everywhere.
You played for the Durham Bulls, and that they became, you know, in the 80s, it came back, Kevin Costner, Durham, Bull Durham, the movie comes out. All of a sudden, it was a cool thing. And you know, I've got, you know, a lot of questions about Durham, but what was it like to play for the Durham Bulls?
Wasn't romantic at that time, but Durham was a great place to play. They had a great ballpark, good fans. We were in first place most of the time.
Yeah.
We're in the playoffs. Ran a lot of good players through there. Clyde was the manager again. Durham was great.
Martin Luther King is assassinated in April 1968. I can't help but notice that you are in Memphis in 1968 playing. You end up, I think you were between Durham and Memphis in that year. But what was it like to be in Memphis in 1968?
Well, at a spring training, they send us to Memphis a week after Martin Luther King was shot. So we got in Memphis. There were protests. There were garbage strikes, garbage all over the place. They wouldn't pick it up, of course. Wife's father called and said, now don't march at any protests because it's dangerous. Yeah. And we're worried that you're going to get hurt. They're Kathy.
Yeah.
And it was a very tough time.
Yeah, and I can imagine that, you know, even on being on a team at that time where, you know, you are a team, you're truly a team, and you're together, and you have all this stuff going on around the country, and given what you'd come from, including your experience in Greenville, it must have been a surreal time.
It was. I think we had a couple of black players on the team back then, and they weren't allowed to live in places that we could live in. They had to live in poorer parts of town, more dangerous parts of town. So it was an experience.
Talking to my dad, former minor league baseball player. All right, before I cut you loose, I had pointed out like an hour ago, you hit seven home runs in that last season?
Seven home runs in a month.
In a month. And then you say, that's good, I'm good?
I'm good.
You know, that was
it's
it.
Great.
Did you have regrets? Did you think 2 years out? Because they didn't release you, did they? Like when you said,
no.
I'm not coming, they kept you under contract.
That's right.
They thought you were holding out.
I never got released. That was my goal. But I was 24. You think 24 is young.
It's young.
But no.
Sorry, Adriana.
I thought for baseball.
Yeah.
I thought 24 was old. We had guys in that league that were 25, 26, 27, 28. And I thought, I don't want to be one of those guys.
Yeah.
I always thought, you know, 3 years in the minors and then you go to the big leagues and have a career. But when I was 24, I think I was the average age or maybe one year less old than the average age.
I talked to Duffy Dyer years ago. I talked to Larry Bernarth, who was one of your teammates, was a pitching coach later with the Rockies and the Detroit Tigers. And he told me your dad should have stuck with it. He would have been in today's game. He would have been one of those utility middle infielders. And was there any part of you a year later, 2 years later after retiring that said, you know what? I'm not done.
No, nothing. I was dead.
Really?
That
it wasn't fun anymore.
No, it wasn't fun.
There you have it.
Yeah.
All right, but now could you hit today? If we went out in the backyard right now and I threw you some wiffle balls, do you think you could hit?
I could hit.
Yeah?
I could hit that.
I love that. You set up a wiffle ball field in the backyard for the grandkids.
I did. So when I look out the kitchen window, I see a scoreboard. And I see the outfield fence, 355, a couple of foul poles, and a Starbucks sign and a Budweiser sign on it. So when I look out at there, it makes me smile.
All right. Are you surprised at all that you got, you know, your kids have all grown up and done different things? You know, we talk about, you know, the, you know, my brother, your son, your other son, who's a special ed teacher, and you got a daughter who is, you know, got a love for dogs and is breeding Newfoundland dogs, and another daughter who is in the Bay Area working with kids. And but did you see me as a radio host, newspaper writer, as a 10-year-old kid? Is this surprising to you that you're here on radio all these years later?
No, it's not surprising at all. You used to do a play-by-play in your bedroom all alone. You did all the baseball cards and all the baseball games. What was it? Was it Nagamko?
No, it was long ball.
Long ball.
You roll the dice and reenact the game.
Yeah.
It wasn't a video game. It wasn't that cool.
And then, you know, Grandpa could entertain with nothing. He would just talk. And you have that same ability. Grandpa was a hobo, used to ride the rails. And he would talk about the hobos getting together around a fire, and he could entertain them just telling stories. So you have that.
He would have loved being on this show. I would have never got the mic back. It would have been, that would have been done. Thank you for joining us. I told you it was going to be a 15-minute interview. I appreciate you making time for us. If anyone wants the full interview, grab the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, Apple Podcast. Thank you, Dad, for joining us. Appreciate you. Thanks for all you've done for me, too.
Oh,
I can remember, too, we talk about storytelling. You're an outstanding storyteller, and I can remember you taking me to the bookstore, introducing me to short stories, and really fostering a love of writing and literature, too. Jack London books and short stories. Mm. So thank you for that.
Okay.
Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth.